There's a swinging town I know called Capital City. People stop and scream hello in Capital City.
Kids, look!
Street crime.
It's the kind of place that makes a bum feel like a king.
Wow, that's service.
And it makes a king feel like some nutty cuckoo super king.
Look, it's Tony Bennett.
Hey, good to see you.
Well, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Hey, everyone. I feel like we don't really do intros or greetings on the Patreon apps anymore, because presumably if people are listening here, they know it's us.
Well, I'll let people in on the sausage making a little bit. I think there are times when, because it's the Patreon, because we're all a family here, you know, we like to cultivate a family atmosphere. You know, you're just coming in on Luke and me as we're hanging out. But then there are other times when I like the sense of relaxed formality. I like some structure. I like some rules. Sometimes I think that makes a difference. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, speaking of structure and rules, we probably should mention that we are going to do the Superdelegate episode for November, but we're going to do it next week.
That's right, folks. Superdelegates, you're not going to get cheated out of anything. I promise you that. You're going to get it. We're just waiting an extra week.
Although, truly, I don't know what we're going to do, because there was our first ever tie. We have a Bush-Gore-style tie, 36% apiece for Dark City, 1998, and Get Out, 2017, with When the Wind Blows getting 29%, the kind of result Ralph Nader could only have dreamed of.
Well, there's a good excuse for us to not do a Superdelegate episode right now. I guess we have to do another runoff poll. Unprecedented.
a second runoff.
Democracy works yet again, folks. But yeah, we're here at Luke's apartment. We haven't been together in a few weeks. We're just chilling in the same room, I mean. How have you been doing? Have you been watching anything? Have you been doing anything?
Well, I'll tell you, last night, my girlfriend and I watched an amazing movie. I mean, not a good movie, but a film that I instantly thought, I have to talk to Will about this. Have you seen the 2009 apocalyptic disaster movie, 2012?
Yes, I have. I saw it at the time as one of the tastemakers, as one of the media elite. I'm proud to say that I saw it at a press screening. I have an encyclopedic memory for when and where and why I saw things. And I can't remember what I thought of it. I remember things that were in it. Like, I remember Woody Harrelson plays a environmentalist guy who lives in the woods
Something. He plays like a kind of survivalist guy who's like, would be a QAnon dude today. Uh-huh. And the character doesn't make any sense, because the whole premise is that he's this crazy guy that does apocalyptic broadcasts from inside of Yellowstone National Park, but then, like, he's completely right.
Well, it's like being a premature anti-fascist, right? Like, history has had a way of ostracizing people who were on the right side of history too soon. Reminding you that they were still crazy. You can still disregard them. Actually, one thing I do remember about it is the main character, the protagonist, just a kind of ordinary dad, is played by left Twitter celebrity John Cusack.
Yeah, my good buddy.
Your friend John Cusack. Uh-huh. We'd love to have him on the show. And a wonderful actor too, John, if I can call you John.
I mean, you're saying it as a joke, but I mean, I have literally talked to him on numerous occasions, and, you know, one does call him by his first name.
Well, let's get him in here. Let's get him in the room with us.
I legitimately do hope to make that happen at some point.
All right, we're gonna, you, me, and the star of Bullets Over Broadway are gonna start riffing together, and I cannot wait. But yeah, in 2012, the main character, played by friend of the show John Cusack, doesn't he have like a son or a daughter, like just a child who is wetting the bed? That's like one of the subplots of the film. And then at the very, very end of the film, when half of civilization has been destroyed and they're all on like a boat that has saved the few remaining members of civilization, they're all looking out at the sunset and they're all happy because, you know, crisis averted. You know, we're alive and we're going to rebuild civilization, and isn't that great? And the last line of the movie is the kid saying something like, "Dad, I held it the whole night." And John Cusack's like, "Good for you." And then it ends on that triumphant, upbeat note. A movie where half of civilization has been wiped out ends with a kid triumphantly not wetting the bed, and that's the feel-good
moment.
It
was all worth it, folks. Yeah. 3 billion people are dead, but little Janie is no longer wetting the bed. The movie is so weird. It's like multiple movies stitched together. It's more than 2.5 hours long. It has so many plots that are kind of A plots. They're given the weight of A plots that it's kind of asking you to invest in. There's a whole bunch about it that doesn't really make sense. Like, the John Cusack character is supposed to be this guy who's like a famous writer, and his most famous book is called like Finding Atlantis or something. Mm-hmm. But then he's also supposed to, he's held up as a failure of some kind, and he like drives around some Russian plutocrat in a limo, which like, doesn't really make sense. He's a famous enough writer that people recognize him, but then he's also just like this deadbeat, like loser dad. He gets like parent cucked by this guy called Gordon, and his son likes Gordon better and calls him by his first name, like calls the John Cusack character by his first name. There's this whole plot where Danny Glover is the president and he refuses to get on the plane. You know, he won't get on Air Force One to fly to China, where, you know, the world's 20 most important and powerful nations have spent like decades building this multi-trillion dollar program where they're going to have multiple arcs to save humanity. And there's this whole plot that's inferred, or character arc that's inferred, or that you have to infer, where Danny Glover, is his wife has died and he's estranged from his daughter, but then it's just never explained what it is. There's an amazing scene where, you know, having refused to leave the White House, Danny Glover is somehow the last person alive in Washington, D.C., and then he just, like, watches as the tsunami consumes the White House. That's the thing that is the funniest about this movie, is it is kind of supposed to be a, like, well, this is where climate change is headed, folks. Like, just total ecological breakdown in, like, the span of 2 days. We'll all be fucked. And yet it's also, in the world of the movie, at least 20 countries have been able to collaborate for decades on a program to save the human race, which honestly is a pretty ambitious kind of thing to put in an apocalyptic movie, or rather a pretty optimistic thing.
So that movie is directed by Roland Emmerich, who in the 90s made Independence Day and Godzilla, and then in the 2000s made The Day After Tomorrow, all of which were these big movies which were kind of resuscitating this form that was popular in the 70s, the disaster movie. Towering Inferno, Earthquake, movies like that, where it's this tapestry of stars, you know, with all these million subplots, and, you know, the big disaster happens and you follow all these subplots. He kind of revived that for the 90s. And as we know from Adam Curtis, those movies really hit the zeitgeist, or Independence Day did at least, as this artifact of the world's last superpower imagining its own destruction. Now, 2012, which I think did okay when it came out.
I think it made a lot of money, actually.
But I don't know, like, I don't feel like it quite hit the zeitgeist in the same way. People didn't love it. People didn't talk about it.
No, it just did well. It was commercially successful.
Yeah, it was the movie.
But not culturally so.
Yeah, it was the movie that people saw that weekend because it was out and because there were a lot of ads for it. It feels like it came out at this interim moment. If that exact same movie had come out today, possibly it would have meant something different. Coming out in the first year of the Obama presidency, you know, when Trump was a mere gleam in his mother's eye, but also like post-Iraq, post-9/11, long after the end of history. I'm not quite sure what thesis I'm building up towards here, except to say that I feel like it came out at a moment where it wasn't quite the moment for that movie. It's different than the Marvel movies to become so popular since, because those movies also envision civilization on the verge of collapse, only to be saved by these superheroes at the last moment and restored to normal. But this is a movie, 2012, is like pornographically interested in the destruction of cities, you know, mass chaos, mass death. I'd like to see somebody try to prove me right that this would resonate more in the current context.
What's great about 2012 is that, you know, it used like the most state-of-the-art special effects for all the city destruction, but it still looks like a video game. Like, it's really meticulously done. Hundreds of millions of dollars went into it, and it still looks totally cartoony and ridiculous, which lends the movie at times this almost camp quality. Like, if the movie is self-aware, I actually think it's brilliant. There are so many scenes where, you know, John Cusack is like about to die. He's like running to catch up with a plane as like
a building's about to fall and the plane has to outrun the building.
Yeah, or a volcano's going to erupt or something like that. And then his kids are just screaming like, "Daddy!" or whatever.
as long as John Cusack survives, it's all okay. The entire city of San Francisco can be underwater.
But it, like, the movie has this like campy quality. Like, there were death scenes in it. Like, when Gordon finally dies, like when the new replacement dad finally dies, it's very funny because for over 2 hours, Gordon escapes every kind of natural disaster. The plane escapes, you know, the San Andreas Fault collapsing in on itself. And then when they finally get onto the Ark, when they sneak onto the Ark, he gets like sucked into some like cogs or something. And he has this really gruesome death. And I gotta tell you, it was pretty funny. Total mess of a movie, kind of oddly fun to watch nonetheless.
I've been watching fewer movies than I normally do. I've been a bit busy lately. And the things that I've been gravitating towards have been a strange mixture of things. As we said in the last episode, I watched the whole Beatles documentary, Get Back, because it's very gentle, it's very pleasant, it's very warm, and you don't have to follow it all that closely. You don't have to follow it that closely, but also there are a million things to follow if you want to. All the dynamics in there. The other thing that I've been watching a lot of are the films of one Fred Halstead, who I'm very excited to tell you and the listeners about. I'm interested in all forms of cinema. I'm interested in cinema at the margins. I'm interested in finding the forgotten closets of film history.
This is Will's roundabout way of telling you all that he's spent the last few weeks watching gay porn.
Yes, that is actually true. And when I tell somebody like you about Fred Halstead, it seems like the most extreme kind of cinema. But what's funny is, if you were talking to somebody who knew something about gay porn and you said, oh, I'm getting really into Fred Halstead, that's like saying to a normal cinephile, oh, I'm interested in Stanley Kubrick.
Right, right.
It'd be like, oh yeah, well he's obviously the best. it's the normiest gay porn filmmaker you can investigate.
But you were telling me this guy was a part of sort of like the New York, you know, 1960s, 70s kind of Andy Warhol, like bohemian scene.
Yeah, I mean, well, there were kind of two really important gay porn filmmakers from the early 70s. One was called Wakefield Poole. He made a movie called Boys in the Sand and another movie called Bijou. Like, he's really the Stanley Kubrick of gay porn. He's the one, he died recently and he got a big obituary in the New York Times.
So, I mean, he made art films.
Yeah, he made art films that were also gay porn films. And, you know, Wakefield Poole was an East Coast guy. He knew Andy Warhol. He started as a dance choreographer in New York theater and worked with all sorts of people before turning to gay porn as a career. Now, Fred Halstead is like the evil Wakefield Poole. He was West Coast. He was really into the leather scene, the BDSM scene on the West Coast. Was interested in sex almost primarily as like an avenue of dominance and power. And his films reflect that. His key films are LA Plays Itself, Sex Tool, and The Sex Garage, although he made a number of other ones. They were all just recently released on a beautiful Blu-ray that Vinegar Syndrome put out, the films of Fred Halstead. I encourage everyone to get this, just to support it, just to support the restoration and the preservation of movies like this, because I understand that the market is not actually huge for them. And pornography of the early 70s can be interesting because there's actually not that huge of a class or hierarchical difference, or at least they exist in the same ecosystem from underground experimental films of the time. Somebody like Fred Halstead would have been, in fact, I think he knew Kenneth Anger, who was one of the great experimental filmmakers. He was in the same ecosystem as a lot of people who were doing stuff like that. And in fact, he is the only gay pornographer to have films in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. LA Plays Itself is this kind of two-part film where the first half takes place in, you know, a beautiful meadow and a beautiful forest, woodland, stream, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, what happens there, exactly what you would expect. But, you know, it's shot in this very arty, abstract style, very indebted to the avant-garde films of the time. And then the second half is shot in the mean streets of LA. A lot of documentary footage of just the slums, Skid Row, hustlers of the time plying their trade. And of course, some much rougher sexual activity in the second half of the film. Now me, I'm a squeamish guy. I was looking at some of this stuff, you know, with my hands over my eyes. So he made a few films, and his big bid for the mainstream was a movie from 1975 called Sex Tool. He thought, this is going to be the one that is the crossover film between gay porn and the art house. So he shot it on 35mm. Almost all gay pornography was shot and exhibited on 16mm at the time, because it was a very niche art form. The theaters had the cheaper projectors, the filmmakers had the cheaper equipment. So basically there was no market on the gay porn circuit for a 35mm film. They just couldn't play it. And then he took it to the art houses and they were like, sorry, there is so much fisting in this film. Like, we cannot play this in our art houses. So this movie had essentially no audience, no exhibition. But it's an incredible film. It's a beautiful film about, like, this ambiguously gay person who is led into this underground, mysterious nightlife world. And there are a series of vignettes, all of them kind of sadomasochistic in nature, that reflect some aspect of gay life at the time, but abject, sort of creating a tapestry of the dark underbelly of gay life. These films are quite interesting, you know, in addition for their artistic value, which is considerable, but also just as tokens of a particular time and place. Not long after these movies were made, all pornography, but in particular gay pornography, became very standardized. It became very assembly line. An industry was erected.
And were there not several failed attempts? I mean, the most notable one being Deep Throat, to kind of marry big budget cinema with pornography.
Well, Deep Throat was interesting because it was actually like a fluke. That was just an actual porn film. And it was probably one of the better porn films of the time, to be honest, just because it was so early. But that was one that it was just the right place at the right time, and it became a massive hit, just as kind of like a freak show. People like Andy Warhol, people like Johnny Carson were just going to see the movie because it was a happening. And so there was this thought, well, maybe the two industries might merge at some point. Maybe hardcore would become mainstream. And so in straight pornography, which of course was much better funded than gay pornography, certain movies started to emerge, like The Devil and Miss Jones or the opening of Misty Beethoven, that were artistically ambitious. Movies that owed something to Bergman or Fellini, to cite the two filmmakers that those two films were aping. So Sex Tool by Fred Halstead was definitely part of that moment. But Halstead was also working at a time before the industry had really become codified, back when it was an outlaw film industry, before it was really an industry. Movies like those wouldn't be possible. Movies that kind of artistically ambitious wouldn't be possible. In fact, the theaters themselves wouldn't want movies like that after a while, because the theaters themselves would basically just become cruising grounds. The sex films, particularly in theaters that showed gay pornography, yeah, they were cruising grounds, and they wanted movies that would just sort of provide some ambient...
eroticism.
Ambient eroticism. Just some mood music for what was happening in the seats. And then, of course, in the 1980s, AIDS hit. Fred Halstead didn't die of AIDS, but his partner, Joey Yale, did. Countless people in the arts who were gay died of AIDS, and also a whole new kind of respectability politics came to the forefront of gay life in the 80s and 90s too, which made a movie like Sex Tool, you know, or LA Plays itself, very unfashionable for, let's call it, the gay bourgeoisie. I mean, now that these films have been reissued on a beautiful restored Blu-ray that has the logo of the Museum of Modern Art at the beginning of them, like...
Well, they finally achieved a kind of respectability.
Yeah, I guess so, and, you know, it's
they have, like, the Library of Congress, like, stamp on them.
I mean, it's like what John Huston says in Chinatown: of course I'm respectable, I'm old. Politicians, ugly buildings, and horrors all become respectable if they last long enough. That's his famous line from that movie. Well, you know, that's kind of the case here. They're starting to be grandfathered in as these tokens of an earlier time in gay life.
Well, it's like how John Waters is just considered this sort of, like, adorable mascot now.
Exactly.
And it's like when he was making films in the 70s, mm-hmm. they were considered kind of dangerous and repellent.
Yeah, definitely. But anyway, folks, Fred Halstead, interesting person to look into. There's also a good book about him that I've been reading called Halstead Plays Himself that I recommend.
Well, something I've been watching, which I think would be good to talk about, because I'm not sure we'll ever be able to do a full episode on it, just because it's one of those requests we get for a TV series. And, you know, until we have kind of 10,000 patrons a month, I'm not sure, you know, Will and I are going to be able to quit our day jobs and do anything that time and labor intensive. But I've been watching Parks and Recreation, which we've gotten a lot of requests to do. Have you ever seen it?
I've seen fleeting episodes here and there. We do get a lot of requests for that. I think because I get the sense that people think it has sort of, like, Hillary Clinton-ish politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's very strange, because so I will say on the record, like, I mean, I think it's a very funny show. The first few seasons in particular are very good. A lot of the characters are really good, even, like, ones you wouldn't expect. The Chris Pratt character, his whole conceit is just that he's a dumb guy, and actually the show's able to wring quite a lot of humor.
Unlike in real life when he's a noted public intellectual.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. The Amy Poehler character, Leslie Knope, is very funny, at least in the early season she is. And, you know, I think it might have been one of our listeners a while back on Patreon who remarked of the show that early on you're kind of supposed to be laughing at the main character. Like, she's more of a, she's like the political equivalent of a Michael Scott or something. But then as the show kind of wears on, and as you kind of get into Obama's second term, as it were, you're supposed to be kind of rooting for her. And that's pretty much what I've experienced. The show is honestly at its best when it's just a sitcom like The Office, because it basically is like an Office sitcom. And it's very pleasant. The characters are really charming. The Ron Swanson character is great. The Audrey Plaza character, who's used pretty sparingly, is, I think, probably the funniest person on the show. But then round about season three, they add a bunch of new characters. There's this really funny thing where the male lead for the first two seasons just vanishes and it's never explained. And he's like, the show disappeared one of its main characters because the guy just left the show. Apparently every person who was ever on Parks and Rec reunited for some kind of like Christmas special or something. Maybe it honestly might have been a get out the vote for Biden special or something, except for this guy. Like, he was just erased with no acknowledgement from the universe. And, you know, kind of watching the show in the evenings after work, and it takes you a few episodes to be like, wait, what happened to that guy? But as the show wears on, and you kind of get to like season three or four, you know, they add a Rob Lowe character. So that's, you know, just a guy from the West Wing. I think Bradley Whitford from the West Wing also has an appearance. They had this character played by Adam Scotti, who I think was an SNL guy. And like, nothing against him, he's perfectly funny. I can't stand Rob Lowe. But Adam Scotti turns out to be the love interest for Leslie Knope. And the show suddenly wants us to place these great emotional stakes in their relationship. It starts celebrating rather than ridiculing the fact that they're like political nerds or whatever. And yeah, for the first few seasons, I was really able to enjoy these parody versions of like the kinds of people, you know, I've come across. I was a political staffer, like I've been, you know, doing politics stuff beginning with my late teens right up to the present. And, you know, yeah, you do meet those kind of like politics nerd people where like the nerddom precedes the politics. So it's less like they're particularly political than just the object of their nerddom happens to be politics. The show's really good at like parodying people like that. One of the things about the Leslie Knope character is she just has all these pictures of women she finds inspiring in her office. And so it's like Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, but then there's just like Condoleezza Rice as well. And like, you get the sense for the first few seasons that like that's supposed to be funny. Not just funny because like this is an unelected person who's like the, I don't know, like deputy head of Parks and Recreation in this like small city in Indiana, and she like sees herself as part of this sort of great power lineage, but also funny because it's not really a coherent political identity and we're kind of supposed to be laughing at it. But then as the show progresses, it gets less and less of that, and it really does just become a like, whoa, politics is cool kind of show. Like, there's this whole sequence where they go to Washington and a bunch of U.S. senators have a cameo. Like, Leslie Knope is upset because of something that's happening with her boyfriend, and she's like all upset in like a cloakroom or something, and someone comes over and you can't see his face, and he's like, you doing okay over there? And she's just like, oh, go away. And he's like, okay, didn't mean to bother you. And then the camera pans up and like, it's John McCain. And you're supposed to be like, whoa, John McCain, that's so cool. So very funny show. I've actually gotten a lot of enjoyment out of it. But yeah, politically, by about season three or four, it has a direction of travel that I feel like encapsulates a sensibility from about 2012 that's still with us in some ways and is a little bit difficult to articulate. But it's one I associate with things like Pod Save America, with the kind of soy banter of Marvel and like various Joss Whedon properties. It's the one I associate with certain kinds of people who went to work in the Obama administration and thought of themselves as these outsiders because, you know, they'd rebelled against orthodoxy and they'd gone with this renegade senator from Illinois instead of Hillary Clinton. And it's like, I'm sorry, that's, you know, that's the equivalent of like Pepsi being, you know, the choice of a new generation or something. Captures that sensibility very well. Like that sort of very 2012 thing of
people working in kind of lavishly paid white collar jobs and then constantly pantomiming, you know, being nerds in this very public way as like their, you know, public identity or something.
Well, I'm glad Chris Pratt got the hell out of there. Good for him. Well, folks, we do have, I guess, a main thing. I hesitate to say movie that we can talk about on this episode. We have a thing that Luke and I, several things actually, that Luke and I watched in the minutes preceding this recording. Ugh. You know, here's the thing. Like, we kind of took it easy on this episode, but we also kind of didn't. To watch the Beatles documentary, I got a Disney Plus subscription. Now, folks, I'm not going to keep it. But
didn't you just tweet, like, imagine having Disney Plus on your credit card statement?
I know I tweeted that, okay? And I'm ashamed of it. But, you know, maybe my family wanted to watch the Beatles documentary. And maybe I did, too. So anyway.
Ever heard of Pirate Bay?
Yeah, that's not gonna fly at my father's house, I'm afraid. Anyway, one advantage of Disney Plus, and I hate to even give them this credit, but they do have The Simpsons on it. So, you know, I've been noodling around, watching some old Simpsons while I have this subscription, but they also have some new Simpsons. They have some new Simpsons content.
And by new, you mean all the Simpsons that has been made over the past 25 years.
I mean, yeah, the Simpsons is like 75% bad now, I want to say.
I mean, I think that's being way too generous.
But there are also several short films that have been made specifically for the Disney Plus channel.
Oh, really? Like 26 short films about Springfield, that kind of thing?
So we watched three such short films.
Now wait just a minute. I came here to collect my dad. But I can see you need cheering up. And nothing works better than a good old Disney song.
We've talked about The Simpsons on this podcast before. It's a good evergreen subject. I actually think this kind of fits in Michael and House wheelhouse territory because The Simpsons is something you and I and probably many of our listeners grew up on. And The Simpsons, as we've said before, is something that helped shape our sense of humor, our sensibility, our cultural outlook. I don't want to pretend that The Simpsons was any kind of radical show. It certainly wasn't. But what it does tell people, it's like Mad Magazine. When you're 8 years old and you're watching The Simpsons or you're reading Mad, what it tells you to do is distrust authority, distrust our institutions. The preacher on the show, Reverend Lovejoy, he's a bit of a boob. The newsman, Kent Brockman, he's a bit of a boob.
Chief Wiggum, idiot.
Exactly. The mayor, corrupt. Entertainers like Krusty, they're just slapping their names on any product, much like how Matt Groening himself is, with little care or interest. Again, the show's not radical, but these are healthy and good lessons to learn when you're 8 or 9 years old. And that's why these short films, I think, really, really hurt to watch.
I just want to say by way of some exposition, you know, for those of you out there who have not seen or heard of The Simpsons, Disney Plus does accompany its various properties with little capsule descriptions so you know what you're getting into. Shout out to Krang T. Nelson, who tweeted the one for 1989's The Simpsons, which I'm just going to read for you all. But what's so great about this capsule description is that every point of it is strictly and formally correct. But as you'll hear, everything about it is ultimately off, and there's something quite unsettling about it. There's a bit of a, you know, an invasion of the body snatchers type of situation going on here. So it reads, "This animated comedy focuses on the eponymous family in the town of Springfield. The head of the Simpson family, Homer, is not a typical family man. A nuclear plant employee, he does his best to lead his family, but often finds that they are leading him. The family includes loving, blue-haired matriarch Marge, troublemaking son Bart, overachieving daughter Lisa, and baby Maggie."
You know, he tries to lead his family, but they lead him, including that battle axe of a wife that he's got, right?
But you see what I mean about how every point of that is strictly correct, and it's like that in no way captures what The Simpsons actually is.
Yeah. So we're gonna go through these one at a time. Actually, the first one we can kind of dispense with pretty quickly. Each of these shorts is an exercise in corporate synergy. Disney has bought The Simpsons as part of its gigantic acquisition of 20th Century Fox, and they have used The Simpsons in a variety of ways as friendly mascots to call attention to the multitude of offerings they have on their services. They've enslaved this family and sent them out there to perform. And each of these short films is all about highlighting some of the Disney Plus family. So the first of them was called Maggie Simpson in The Force Awakens from Its Nap. There's not much to say about this one. It's like,
Maggie goes to a daycare and everything is Star Wars. So when the kids are bad, they get frozen in carbonite and they get put on the wall.
And there's also a Darth Maul baby who she has a lightsaber fight with.
There's a kid who's building something or he's standing next to something that says, Death Star, guaranteed unexplodable. And they bump into it and would you believe it explodes? Just like it does in the end of A New Hope.
Now there's another one called The Simpsons, The Good, The Bart, and The Loki. Oh. This is the Marvel one. Oh. That's another one of Disney's big properties where it opens in... Folks, I'm not going to be perfect on the Thor mythology here, but it opens on that...
Who cares?
It opens on that rainbow road that they've got in the Thor movies that connect... Okay, this is a funny pet peeve I have with the Marvel movies. Apparently, Greek mythology is true in them. Like, they're just, like, normal, like, semi-realistic movies where, like, Iron Man is just, like, a billionaire and they've got the Department of Defense and shit like that. But also, like... Thor, the Greek god.
It's just a real guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just didn't really... He and Zeus just didn't really have anything to say for like 2,500 years.
So, the boy says you're magic. Can you turn one pork chop into two? I worship you, great Loki. Command me, O Lord. I renounce all other gods.
The last thing this world needs is more pork chops.
It opens with Loki, the what is he? Is he the villain or the anti-hero or the semi-hero? Is he Thor's brother? I can't. Folks, write in. Let me know. Loki, the character you all know, played by Tom Hiddleston in those movies. He's on the Rainbow Road and he gets kicked out of heaven or whatever it is they have there. And he doesn't get to go to New York. He doesn't get to go to Paris. He has to go to, Springfield? So he finds himself in the home of the Simpson family. And
look, God, it's like we just watched it, but and it was like very unpleasant. But now as you recapitulate it, I'm finding it quite upsetting.
Loki is a shapeshifter. So, you know, he's always shifting into the guises of various Simpsons. And Lisa... stumbles upon, I can't remember how, but she stumbles upon the hammer of Thor.
He expels her. They're having dinner and he like expels her on Bart's, you know, asking. And then she ends up in a cell somewhere where she gets the Thor's hammer. She gets muscles and she flies and she just flies home.
And that turns her into Thor. And then she unites the Springfield Avengers around her. So it's like Barney Gumble in the Iron Man costume. It's Herman of Herman's Military Antiques holding the Captain America sword. Little Ralph Wiggum as the Incredible Hulk. All of them are around in various Marvel outfits. And then the short ends. Very upsetting to see. I don't want to waste too much time on this because the real main event is a short called The Simpsons in Plusiversary. Now, this short came to my attention through a tweet from the official Disney Plus account that had a picture of the poster for this, which was Homer and Goofy sitting at a table at Moe's Tavern arguing with each other about something or conversing about something.
Can I just read the point-by-point summary of this? Because it's only a few sentences long, and I think that's the only way we're going to be able to capture what's actually going on here.
Oh, okay, you can do that. But what I want to do is I want to read the tweet that accompanied this poster because okay. It is so hateful. It said, "So... The Simpsons threw us a party and things got goofy. Celebrate hashtag Disney Plus Day with the all-new short, The Simpsons in Plusiversary, streaming November 12th. There's something about the soy banter of that tweet I find so upsetting. I find so upsetting the idea that the official Disney Plus account says that The Simpsons threw them a party. Like The Simpsons, that the family that we all know and love... are so happy to
they
be.
Invited us in.
They're yeah. So happy to be there. They wanted to throw a party for the whole Disney gang.
Well, that's what's so upsetting about all of this is it's like we've achieved a new level of cultural dystopia where corporate monopolism is self-aware and is just like waving itself in your face constantly. Like everything is just Space Jam, A New Legacy now. Everything is Ready Player One where it's like, oh yeah, all the properties are together. And so yeah, just by way of plot, this is what happens in the plus of
And you're reading from
Wikipedia.
Okay.
Several Disney characters are lined up to enter Moe's Tavern, where Maleficent is checking the guest list to enter, and Homer is complaining he's not on the list. However,
wait, I thought The Simpsons threw them the party.
However, when Goofy appears, he forces him to be his plus one. At the tavern, Darth Vader is drinking a beer, Doctor Strange is playing pool, Elsa is creating some ice in a bucket that a Fantasia's broom is filling with beer, while Buzz Lightyear and the Mandalorian are having an arm wrestling contest that Buzz loses, and Mo thinks that Donald Duck is choking, so Barney tries to do a Heimlich maneuver on him.
And in the bathroom, Cinderella is hooking up with Don Knotts from the Apple Dumpling Gang, while Dick Van Dyke as Bert watches.
At the table, Homer and Goofy are discussing, while Happy is complaining how the party stinks before complaining to Grumpy, and they get divided. So those are from the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And they get divided by Lisa, who comes to the tavern to collect Homer, who gets his beer stuck by BB-8, who gets his beer struck by BB-8.
Oh, I love BB-8. My favorite character, BB-8. Don't you love him, folks? BB-8.
Lisa then cheers the place up with a song about Disney Plus. Now, I'm going to pause here. This is the main thing that this so-called animated short does. I just want to read you the lyrics here. This has to be heard to be believed. I don't think I've ever encountered an example of this kind of in-your-face, post-ironic corporate self-awareness that is this insidious, this heinous. Lisa sings, "Streaming's a dream for Disney, all content in one place. It's beamed all over the planet and into outer space. If your kids are driving you crazy, entrust them to the TV. You'll never find a sitter for our low monthly fee."
Killer, killer, shoot her in the head. That's not Lisa anymore.
"Disney Plus for kids that are older, but best of all for Disney stockholders," showed cuts to Mr. Burns.
That's right. It cuts to Mr. Burns because, like, it's kidding. Kidding, not kidding. Like,
So let's all celebrate Disney Plus as it reaches year number two. As long as we have your credit card number, it will automatically renew. And then the chorus singers sing, "Renew, renew, automatically renew." I mean, you were talking about Greek mythology here. Continuing on that theme, I think The Simpsons has become like Prometheus, you know? The Simpsons is now just being punished by the gods, and its punishment is immortality. It will never die. The Simpsons was too funny. It stole the fire of the gods. Now it's doomed to be nailed to a mountain where, you know, the culture just like devours its liver every single day for eternity, and it's never allowed to die.
When The Simpsons was on Fox, they were constantly making jokes about Fox, about the corporation, about the channel itself. They were constantly making little swipes at how the channel was always doing all this tacky programming and, you know, Rupert Murdoch and everything like that. And obviously there's a limit to how radical that is because, you know, it's a Fox property. It's making untold millions for Fox, and the corporation can say, hey, we can laugh at ourselves.
Right, in its own way, it's kind of self-aware.
Yeah. However, I think over the course of 30 years, a certain amount of trust was built between the viewers and this show, where the viewers kind of felt like, well, this show is like an island unto itself within the Fox brand, you know? And maybe I'm overly romanticizing this, and maybe I'm just pointing to the folly of this way of thinking, the ultimate folly of this way of thinking. But The Simpsons developed a sort of trust amongst its audience that, like, yeah, okay, it's a Fox show, but it's real. And people behind it, they're kind of nonconformists within this system, and they'll say what they want. And, you know, I just recently revisited that Itchy and Scratchy Land episode, which is
so
like
good. A
really funny parody of Disney. Like when they go see the little film about Roger Myers, and it's like, Roger Myers Sr. was loved by all, except in 1938 when he made his short film, "Nazi Superman Are Our Superiors." That's the kind of joke they would do. The social satire of the show had a certain amount of teeth, and the Lisa Simpson character was always presented as this rational, smart character who always spoke to our better natures, was always advocating for the right causes, environmentalism, vegetarianism, you know, whatever it was that she was advocating for. And Disney Plus, the evil geniuses at Disney Plus have taken this trust and have turned it against us. They've said, oh, we can leverage this trust. We can use this to our advantage to show that Disney Plus is actually cool and good. That's why it hurts. And it also hurts because, of course, we should have known that it would end this way. This is a corporate product. fucked. They could have
just killed it, though. They could have taken it off the air. Instead, we're left with... Actually, let me... This is a good moment for me to finish summarizing the plot. A little more happens after Lisa finishes singing. After the song, Mickey Mouse's shadow appears over the door to the tavern, overjoying everyone as the boss is arriving, but Bart appears instead, dressed as Mickey, telling him to get back to work and dragging Goofy away while Barney drags Homer the other way. Now, this description's kind of odd because it says that Bart is dressed as Mickey, but I thought what it was doing was that, like, Bart is Mickey. It's telling you...
The two of them went into the machine from The Fly.
The Fly, right, exactly. It's Disney telling you, like, this is a warning about what's to come. What they're saying is, not only can we take all these different characters and reduce them to the status of properties and put them all in the same thing in this decontextualized way, but what we can also do in the future and what's coming is we can, like, combine the characters.
It's times like this when you really have to respect Bill Watterson's decision to not do any merchandise whatsoever around Calvin and Hobbes. I know there are a lot of people who are mad at Bill Watterson for that, being like, would it have killed you to just do, like, one collectible Hobbes plush doll? Like, would that have done any harm? And you know what? Maybe it wouldn't have, but maybe it would have been a slippery slope that would have led to Calvin and Hobbes in Plusiversary.
Yeah, just imagining Watterson being like, they drove a dump truck full of money up to my house. I'm not made of stone.
In the entire history of American popular culture, we've had one guy who held firm and held strong, and we should be thankful for the existence of him.
Protect Bill Watterson.
One last point I'll raise about this is just the standard point about how The Simpsons has been on for over 30 years, and it started when the world was one way, and now it's continuing at a time when the world has changed in many ways, and yet the core of the show, the family it depicts, the society it depicts, has remained frozen in amber, which has led to the show being bad. It's one of the reasons why the show is shit now, because the American nuclear family, as it's depicted on that show, seemed like the norm at the time, but it no longer seems like the default norm. First of all, a guy with an entry-level job at a nuclear power plant wouldn't be able to afford a house like that in the neighborhood that he lives in with that many kids. And then it extends to all the supporting characters, like Krusty the Clown is an imagined archetype from a time before the show existed, and now Krusty the Clown continues to live in this world. The comic book guy was the kind of comic book nerd that existed in the 80s, back when comic books and their associated entertainments were niche things, and now...
Now the entire culture is comic book guy. Exactly. Every single movie is Radioactive Man. Like, the culture is now just, like, the comic book guy and his friends reacting to... Itchy playing Scratchy's ribcage like a xylophone or whatever. That's what we've become, except now it's no longer a joke.
So really, it completely makes sense. When you watch these short films and you see this bar where it's like, oh, there's Sleeping Beauty and there's Goofy and there's Edna Krabappel, sure. And there's Mo and there's Rainier Wolfcastle or whoever else is in the fucking bar. It's like, yeah, of course they're all here. They don't mean anything anymore. They've outlived their usefulness as archetypes and now they've just become a Mr. Brainwash canvas that has all of these things on them. They mean nothing. So to the extent that these Disney Plus shorts like soils them, I mean, they were up for the soiling.
Because I'm not sure exactly how to conclude this episode, we've kind of said everything. I think I'm just going to play with no exposition a clip from The Simpsons that I think is now a few years old. We'll just leave you with this, and you can all marinate on it without our comment. I think it kind of speaks for itself. See you next time.
I usually don't get into politics, but the president's senior advisor, Jenna Ellis, just said Kamala Harris sounds like me. Lisa says she doesn't mean it as a compliment. If that's so, as an ordinary suburban housewife, I'm starting to feel a little disrespected. I teach my children not to name call Jenna. I was gonna say I'm off, but I'm afraid they bleep it.
Oh. Killer.